But in terms of transistors, resistors, everything at that level, that's what I'm going to talk about. So basically, computers, you all know, they think in digital data in zeros and ones, but that isn't how it works. A zero, a one represents something in the real world. It represents a voltage level, a current level, something. And you can represent those as points in a geometry. For the simplest geometry, which is just zeros and ones, you can represent it as a single axis, voltage, and let's say it's 5 volt CMOS, you have 0 to 0 volts, and 1 to 5. You can represent things in 2 dimensions, say voltage, and then imaginary phase and real phase, and then you have points at different levels. You don't have to have 2 points in axis, you can control it, you can modify it to different levels, that allows you to get multiple points along the axis. So I kind of draw out when he's talking.
Let's see what we can do. Because I can't draw and hold a mic at the same time.
Point that.
Nate can point. Excellent. So you can actually extend this to quite a few different dimensions.
I want to see what happens.
You have to aim it, right? So you can extend this beyond the two-dimensional into 3D, 4D, hyperdimensional setups. As many different methods of transmission as you have, that's how many axes you have. Alright. So back to, there are various ways you can represent your data in the analog world. You can have isolated voltage levels, which is what you think of when you see CMOS talking to CMOS. There is current transmission, there has to be for it to work, but the current used is really low because CMOS has a high input resistance. So you basically can think of it as just voltage traveling across a wire. You have current loop systems like RS-232, you're actually sending current down the wire and it's coming back. RS-485, a lot of serial communication systems are set up as current loops. You have optical pulses and fiber, which is, you all know what that is. And you have RF in free space, which is just electromagnetic radiation in free space. Optical is really a special case of that. It's RF energy, it's EM energy in a constrained, in a waveguide, yeah. See, he should give this. It's in a constrained space. Now, I'll go to a new page. Basically, the whole goal in communication is to minimize the chance of any error happening. So if you have, okay, I'm just going to keep this open now. If you have a geometry, let's say it's a real and imaginary geometry, an IQ geometry, and you're transmitting, say, 4 different signals, positive and negative real, the goal is to maximize the space between these, because anytime you receive a signal, it's going to map to a point somewhere in here. The point that you receive is going to be whatever you sent, plus whatever noise and interference happened on the way. So by maximizing the distance between them, you maximize the regions that you can detect, and you maximize the chance of transmitting without an error. And like it says on the screen I'm standing directly in front of, you have an equation. R equals Y plus N, your received signal is your transmitted signal plus the noise. And you should all interrupt me if you have questions at any point. So, yes?
When you're talking about the imaginary real mapping, how are those numbers being transmitted?
They're transmitted as quadrature on a carrier. Okay. So you have a modulation on the sine component and a modulation on the cosine component. You add them together, that's a quadrature signal. I'll go into that a little more later. And this is called a constellation. It's a mapping of different symbols into space, into your geometry. Different methods, amplitude, frequency, phase, shift keys, and amplitude modulations, they all produce different sorts of constellations, but they can all be represented on a diagram of this type. For some of them, you just need a very big diagram. So now you've got enough backing that I can actually talk about this. There are 3 major sources for corruption in transit for most signals. You can have conducted issues when you're working over a wire. You can have inductive issues, which happen on a wire, but only with electromagnetic fields inducing current. And you have the issues you happen when you're radiating into free space. So conducted issues, you have issues where metal touches metal. You have level mismatches, like CMOS to CMOS. CMOS runs at a whole bunch of voltage levels. I've seen CMOS running at 15 volts. I've seen it running at 1.5 volts. If you connect CMOS 1.5 to CMOS 15, it's not going to talk. Your CMOS is looking, here's your VCC is your high voltage, and ground. And you have three areas within here. You have a null area where anything that's in that area, you have no idea what's going to happen. It could be interpreted as a zero. It could be interpreted as a one. It could never see it. You have one and zero, and then you have who knows. Those voltage levels here and here are determined by the process technology and the voltage you're running it at. Yeah, but slew rate's a different issue. Slew rate is how long it'll take to get to that level. Eventually it'll get there. But CMOS 1.5 can never get to a 6-volt level. So it's I know what you're talking about, but the problem is that, let's say 15 volts, your guaranteed maximum output during a low voltage may be 1.5 volts. Your minimum for a high input on a 1.5 volt process may be 1 volt. So you have CMOS 15 saying 0 and CMOS 1.5 seeing 1. You've just had a bit flip. That's an error in transmission. You can have load mismatches, which are CMOS to TTL is a typical example. CMOS is a complementary metal oxide semiconductor. It uses FETs as the outputs. TTL uses bipolar transistors. They work very differently. They have very different load characteristics. Typically, CMOS can drive TTL. TTL may or may not be able to drive CMOS. And they have loading issues where a certain number of gates can talk to a certain number of other gates. Those numbers are really just very dependent on the chip itself in practice, so I don't have numbers for them. But connecting that way, you can often have problems where you'll start intermittently dropping carrier or intermittently dropping a signal. You can also have voltage supply spikes. All of these have to be fed by a real voltage supply. I've never seen a voltage supply that doesn't spike. So if you look at the voltage line, you'd like to see a nice flat level like that. You're probably going to see that in any real system. What's that? I can't draw, so. It looks like that. I've seen it look worse. One thing you'll notice is if you have any clock signals or any heavily clocked systems, you'll see these huge spikes coming in on clock pulses. And about the worst thing I've ever seen is where an ADD was actually spiking into its own reference. So every time the ADD was taking a sample, the voltage it measures against was suddenly twice as high as it was supposed to be. And a similar issue is with CMOS, the inputs, because they have such a high impedance to input to, a very small charge can cause a huge change on the input. That charge can be enough static just coming off the air. So if you leave an input tied to nothing, it could take 0 or 1, whatever it feels like, and that can screw up your results. So just a rule, always tie unused inputs to ground or to voltage, usually to ground. Inductive issues, it's Maxwell's law. You have an oscillating electric current running through an electromagnetic field. It'll produce a current in a wire. And these will annoy you because they change depending on where you are. They will annoy you because they're not easy to find. And I hate these because I work in automotive and there are lots of high current loads that generate a lot of inductive problems.
I'm just getting the screen.
Okay. The most typical example here is 60 hertz fields. So all the power runs at 60 hertz. It oscillates at 60 hertz. It generates fields at 60 hertz, and those fields induce into your equipment. The problem here is an inductive loop. So the problem is that anytime you have a loop of flow, and currents always flow in loops. They always flow back to their source. The idea is that you minimize your loop area, you minimize your susceptibility to inductive problems. The bigger your loop area, the bigger the current that's going to be induced. And a current induction problem can, depending on the impedance of whatever it is that you're measuring with, generate huge problems or very, very small ones. It basically depends on your resistances in the system. And then in radiated and free space links, you have three major problems. You have absorption, which is just they fade as they go through the air. The signal reduces. It's not a problem if you're transmitting into space. It is a problem in air. It may not be a big problem, but over enough distance it is. You have multipath issues where if you have building A and building B, you have somebody here and you're transmitting from up here, you have one signal that bounces You have one signal that goes direct. You have another signal that maybe bounces like that. So you have all these signals. They'll arrive at different times, at different strengths. They'll interfere with each other. And this will make what you're trying to see very hard to see. And you also have something called a fading channel, where the conditions actually change in midair, and they change the way your signal propagates. They're nasty, and if you design cell phones, you get to work with them all the time.
Does reflection on a bus get thrown in the mid as a second category?
Yeah, impedance mismatches would be a... No, they're a conductive issue. Define what you mean by reflection.
Like if you have just a bus and you send signals down, you get reflections back at the end, like termination issues.
Termination issues are impedance mismatches. They're a conductive thing. I talk about them somewhere. I don't remember where. So all those sources that I talked about just basically cause one thing. They cause noise. You add that into the R equals Y plus N notation. It ships your received signal. You compare it to whatever you transmitted. If there's enough of an error, you get the wrong symbol. In some decoders, they're actually doing some intelligent looking. The simplest thing to do is say, okay, whatever I got, that's what I got. There was no noise. Or correct it to the closest symbol in the Hamming distance sense and how close it is on that constellation map. Some decoders actually do a little more intelligent ways of looking at it. And with enough noise, if you're not careful, you can actually throw off those decoders and they'll start, even if they get a correct symbol after that, they'll start throwing out incorrect answers.
They overcompensate.
It's a real problem with stream codes, because in a stream code you have some feedback, so you can actually get into there's something called a catastrophic code, which stream codes can all be represented as state machines, so I'm going to use a state machine diagram. So you might have a state 00, which always feeds to itself for any given signal for 0 and 1. That's a catastrophic code. That's an example of something that can really screw you up when you're doing coding. But more typically, you'll just have 00, and it'll go 1 here and 0 here, but you'll see a 1 when you were supposed to get a 0, and then you're over here in a 0-1 state, and you're no longer in the state you think you should be in. You may not be able to return to a correct state, which means that everything after that point is wrong. Corruption in place is bit rot. It's the things that happen once your data is already down. Magnetic storage is not very good at this. It leaks. The field leaks over time. It just slowly decays. But it's pretty slow. That's not usually a big issue. Printing is not an issue with hard drives, but it is with tape. What happens is you have this reel of tape. So you have a layer of tape here and a layer of tape there. And this layer has 10111 written. Those are slowly going to diffuse into this outer layer. Very slowly, but over time they can actually, if you listen to an old audio tape, you can actually hear an earlier echo almost as the printed through material from 3 seconds later comes through. You also have electromagnetic fields. They can change what's stored on the disk. And energetic particles can actually change what's stored on the disk in the same way. You were?
Yeah. Is the magnetic printing issue getting worse or better with the technology? Is the DLT less successful than an iTrack or more?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer to, but it depends on the field strength that things are stored at. So I would suspect that DLT is stored at a lower strength because the bits have to be closer together. That's the other question. Basically, it's just the distance and the field strength. So you'd have to look it up for DLT versus A-Track, but I would suspect that DLT is worse. You also have chemical storage, which would be CDRs, photonegatives. The things you have to worry about here are the stability of your dye, your chemical, whatever it is that you're storing. CDs, they quote 100 years for dye stability on the archive quality ones, but that's probably at 20 degrees C. There's something called the Arrhenius equation. As heat goes up, the rate increases roughly exponentially, so you can't rely on that because you are going to have environmental factors. There's also substrate stability. If the backing goes, then the dye, it doesn't matter if it's in good condition because it just spilled out all over your floor.
Plus some of your substrates are organic, like,
yeah.
I mean, that's the biggest problem with some film.
There are a lot of different things that can go wrong with your substrate. It depends on the media that you're storing it on. Film can be eaten by fungus. There are all sorts of things that can go wrong. Physical storage is usually pretty good. Press CDs, vinyl, anything that actually stores its data as a physical change in the media.
Clay tablets.
Clay tablets, yeah. We have clay tablets from 4,000 years ago, so we know they last at least 4,000 years with proper treatment. But basically, you're just worried about, is it going to live? Is it going to get broken? So physical is pretty good if you need to store something for a long time. And finally, there's electrical storage, which is probably the worst in terms of archival. Something like that would be non-volatile RAM. Your charge leaks out over time. You have electromagnetic fields that can induce current, that can induce charge changes. Particles can flip bits. And it all happens really easily because there's not a lot of charge stored usually. And the less charge you have, the easier it is to manipulate that charge. It's really about it for corruption. There's so many dependent things with it that I didn't talk a lot about it. Ask questions about corruption now. After this, I'm going to go more heavily into communications and information theory.
Okay. I'm going to ask about twisted pair.
Yes.
Obviously, it's about inductive interference.
Yeah.
And the number of twists per unit length or whatever gives you how close you can be to a source of interference. But when you go from Category 5 to Category 6 cable, you've got the same number of twists per inch, but in Category 5, whereas the individual twisted pairs are allowed to sort of rub against each other and their conductors mingle in between each other, in Cat 6 you have this little divider that runs down the middle of the cable and keeps the pairs separated from each other.
Okay.
Why?
I would assume for crosstalk purposes. Basically, the whole point of the twisted pair is to minimize loop area for inductance. If you have two wires running like this, you have a very long loop that actually has a fair amount of area. If you have twisted pair, the loop area is only the area in between them at any given point in time. You've shrunk your area. So that's why twisted pair. Crosstalk is the usual reason for separating different conductors. This only works if the wires are carrying the same signal in reverse. So if this is positive and this is negative, if they're not related, then they'll talk to each other inductively. You'll get inductive fields inducing charge, and you'll get crosstalk between them. It may not induce a lot of problems, but it will induce problems. So that's why there's actual physical separation in Cat 6.
Capacitive problems, too.
Yeah, probably. You can have capacitive coupling. It's pretty rare in wires. Inductive is usually a bigger problem.
Next question. Are you familiar with crosstalk in optical cables?
I am not, but I can hazard decent guesses usually.
It's a lot of fun.
Okay, that's exactly what I like to hear. No, I don't work with optics at all, so.
Yeah, whatever you do, don't bend them too tight.
Nice.
Photons leak out.
That must be fun.
They leak back into the next fiber over.
Excellent, excellent. Any other questions? Corruption. This is what happens every time you talk a digital communication stream. The two steps all the way on the left, quantize and interpolate, they're only if you need an analog beginning or end point. The other seven steps, the channel is also analog. The other six are digital. This is how every digital communication system in the world works. They all use this process, this flow, so it's a pretty good representation. Quantization, it's one part of analog to digital conversion, the other part is sampling. Basically, let's go. You have an analog signal, it looks like that. It's nice, it's constant. Your digital signal is going to quantize into fixed voltage levels, and it's going to quantize into fixed time points. So what you wind up with looks like that instead. That's the first step, it's just translation into digital. Basically, what's happening is this is infinite information content. I'll get into that in just a little bit. This is a finite information content. You cannot transmit an infinite information content over a finite capacity digital link.
Much as the audio files would like to say otherwise.
They're full of shit. Audio files, I'll not start. So your major issues here are with quantization error and sampling error. Your quantization error is really easy. If you're guessing here and you see here, let's say that, your interpolation, is pretty good. But if your signal did that in the meantime, suddenly you have this huge error in the span between samples. Sampling error would take a long time and a lot of math to go into, so I'm not going to, but it relates to how you're actually sampling and how you reproduce it at the end, how you interpret it. It's there. It'll cause spectral problems, basically, so be aware it's there, and if you need to learn about it, then I'm happy to sit down and talk to you. Next step is compression. You've probably all done this. I hope you have. The whole point is to eliminate whatever redundancy might be in your information content. There are a lot of coding methods. There are three major classes. There's Huffman coding, which is usually fixed. There are adaptive methods. It's based on probabilities of each set of signals. You break it up into a... The way you do it, you wind up with a tree of probabilities, and eventually you come up with a coding method that uses the most frequently sent signals, get short codes. Long signals rely on less frequently used codes. LempelZiV is ZIP, RAR, all of the common compression are LempelZiV, which is it's a dictionary and string substitution approach. And arithmetic coding exists. That's about how much I know about it. So,
where does run length encoding fall into?
It's probably a variation on Huffman, but I am not sure. Huffman provides an optimal code for a given set of data. Run length is... Yeah, add run length. Okay. I'm perfectly happy. I had it in there, too. Like I said, the goal is to reduce your information to transmit to its fundamental content, which is the information entropy. It's H equals the negative sum. That's ugly, so I'll write it in proper notation. It's the sum over I of the probability of given signal I times log 2 pi. And this... Yeah, that's right. Gives you your information content in bits. If you replace log 2 with log 10, you get it in decimal bits. If you replace it with the natural log, you get it in some other weird unit that no one actually uses. So log 2 is what you'll see in pretty much everything. This will tell you how much a given source, the actual entropy, the fundamental entropy, how much information you need to reproduce that source. So for any given string, this will give you the minimum amount of space that you need to reproduce that given an optimal code. And if you have a fixed string that you're going to send, a Huffman code is an optimal code. The problem with Huffman codes is for a source that you don't know what it's going to send ahead of time, they're not optimal because you can't optimize them ahead of time. That's where adaptives come in. They work okay. Encoding, the idea is you're reintroducing a redundancy in a controlled form. You can code it block, you can code it stream, you can code it interleaved. Block, any of you who've done crypto, it's the same thoughts. With block, you look at a block of bits, you encode that block of bits. Stream, you're doing a constant stream of bits through. Interleaved may or may not be used in crypto, I don't know, but you have multiple encoders. They can run in block mode, they can run in stream mode. I've never seen it used, but I suppose you could have an interleaved encoder feeding an interleaved encoder. And you have multiple encoders that feed a stream alternately or in some other pattern, spreading their encoding out, basically. What's that? You use different encodes, so this may be a block code, this may be a stream, and they're putting the same information in there. They're both being fed identically. What happens is you spread your redundancy out even further. Turbo codes use this technique. They're interleaved codes. And as your information spreads, errors are less likely to propagate to an important piece of data.
Satellite radios use that too.
I don't know what coding methods they use off the top of my head. Do you know what their code schemes are?
The reason I was asking is I heard something where they would transmit the same thing a couple seconds apart, so if you wanted to bridge, you wouldn't lose the signal. And I don't know if that is this.
Yeah, that's... That's just repetition, but it's related. It's coding by repetition is your simplest method. It's sending the same thing over and over and over.
But if it's on the same channel, then it qualifies as interleave.
Yeah. But generally, an interleave is used to refer to something where there was actually coding done and then interleaved between. If you just repeat, it could be looked at as a stream code where you have a one-in-three-out stream, or as a block code with a one-in-three-out block. And basically the idea is you've gotten rid of all your redundancy. Now you want to add it back in a controlled fashion so that you can maximize how much spread you get before you get error. So it goes back to the constellation diagram I had earlier. By coding it, you can change where those points sit in space. Common schemes are parity check. You're probably familiar with where you're just adding up. If you have an odd number or an even number, you put a 1 as your last bit or a 0 as your last bit. That's a block scheme example. Stream feedback schemes, you have linear feedback shift registers, so you have feeds in, feeds in, feeds in, feeds through, and then at some point you have feedback, and you have an input, and you have an output, and there may be different manipulations happening depending on what your coding method is. But the idea is that you actually introduce some of your output back in, it allows you to gain some more redundancy in a controlled fashion again. Turbo codes are a good example of interleaved coding. They use, I believe, two block coders interleaving with each other, but I'm not certain on that. Then you modulate. This turns your digital data back into analog data. So now that you've had all this fun digital manipulation, you go back to analog. There are a bunch of different methods. PAM is pulse amplitude modulation, PPM is pulse position, PCM is pulse code, PWM is pulse width, QAM and the others I'll get to in a second. I'm going to go over the different pulse modulations. Pulse amplitude is easy. You just change the amplitude of the pulse you send. You don't change its time, you don't change its position in space. So this might be 00, 01, 10, 11. That's a PAM scheme. If you look at it as a constellation, it's going to look like that. Then you have pulse position, where you have a defined window of time that you're transmitting in. And dependent on when you push your pulse through, that's what you're sending. It'll actually look like that as well, but instead of being an amplitude, you'll have time as your axis.
Yeah, you have to recover a clock somehow.
Yeah, that's why no one actually uses pulse position modulation. All of these, you have to have a clock somehow, but you can recover clock from an amplitude scheme. You can't recover from a pulse position scheme. You have to have synchronized oscillators, and no one uses them for that exact reason.
Or you could have a defined sync bit.
You could, but it's more effort than it's worth, I would suspect. I've never seen anyone actually use it. It's taught as another example. Oh, man, time. Oh, I'm fine. Where was I? Pulse code modulation is sort of like pulse amplitude modulation. You're modulating, instead of one bit at a time, many bits at a time. So you're sending a bit stream that looks like that, maybe. It's really pulse amplitude modulation running at a slower clock rate, but with more signals per symbol. And pulse width modulation uses, again, a defined width, and you're modulating how much of that width you're taking up with your signal. And you can get a lot of different gradations out of that. It's not usually used for communication, but they use it for a lot of other things. What's that?
Servos,
yeah, exactly. I do a lot of work with control systems, so PWM is one of my favorite words. Now we have the more useful methods, as far as I'm concerned, which are FM, AM, PM, the different shift keyings that are the same, and QAM. FM, AM, and PM. FM and AM, you've probably heard of, radio. FM is frequency modulation. You change the frequency over time. AM is amplitude modulation. Both of these can be done as digital or analog schemes. PM is phase modulation. You're changing your phase in time. It is, with some mathematical tricks, equivalent to FM, or FM is equivalent to PM. Then you have the shift key methods. FM, AM, and PM are usually the analog version. They're usually what you would refer to. So you have a continuous signal. FSK, PSK, ASK are shift keys. So in an amplitude shift key, you have a carrier wave that you modulate. Wow, that was a really awful drawing. These are all supposed to be at the same amplitude. So pretend they are. In a shift key system, you would have a certain number of digitally defined signals, and you might modulate off and then back on. So in an amplitude shift key system, you're modulating the envelope of a carrier wave.
So Morse code would count.
Morse code, kind of.
Because you're turning the carrier on and off over time.
Is Morse code sent over a carrier, or is it just sent as pulses?
Well, when you DC, it's sent as pulses, but
it has to be. Well, it depends. I mean, Morse code is just
a code, yeah.
Scheme. I mean, you can send it with flashing lights.
Yeah, you could say that.
If you're doing radio, you're turning your carrier on and off.
Yeah. Morse code radio is an amplitude shift key system. Your remote usually runs on ASK. So your remotes are working on usually a 40 kilohertz carrier with amplitude envelope modulation. FSK and PSK are defined frequencies that you're shifting between, or defined phase points within one frequency that you're shifting between. So you transmit here, then go here, here, and back here, or however your data winds up telling you to transmit. The benefit here is that you're not changing the power that you're transmitting. You're transmitting at a constant power, which usually makes your amplifier design a lot easier and usually makes your power supply a lot more efficient. This is a really inefficient way to transmit, these are more efficient, which is why they're used. They're also more capable, usually. They're easier to build at a higher rate. QAM is quadrature amplitude modulation, and there's a related scheme called QPSK, which is quadrature phase shift key. These are, again, on the real and imaginary axis. QAM, let's do 16. QAM 16 looks like this. So you actually have a combination of, as you circle in this, you're doing phase modulation. And as you go in and out, you're doing amplitude modulation. So you're combining phase and amplitude. You can do mathematical tricks that make it look that way as a combined phase and amplitude modulation. So this would be a 16-point constellation. It would let you send 16 symbols. It's called 16 QAM. And if I remember right, V34 modems use that scheme. So this is used all over the place. Your cell phone uses it or something related to it. Satellites use it. Pretty much everything does. The nice thing is that you can pack a lot of data into a relatively small bandwidth. The problem here is that a circle represents an equal power transmission. So as you can see, you're changing the power that you're transmitting with this scheme, which reduces your efficiency, but usually the gains in terms of coding ease and the ease of building the scheme are outweighed by the fact that usually you don't mind the power inefficiency so much.
So this is when they say 56K modem restricted to 53K because of FCC power limits is because you can't use the corners of that constellation.
56K modems don't actually run on 16 QAM. They run on pulse code modulation, but it's a crosstalk issue again. They don't want to... The amount of power they would need to get enough pulse data out would start leaking into other fibers, although there has been talk with the FCC of removing that limitation. Nothing's materialized yet. QPSK is related to this. Instead of being a rectangular form, QPSK is done on equal power circles. So you may have 4 QPSK, which is on one circle. You may add another circle and have 8. But the benefit here is that you have defined power levels. So if you have an amplifier that can do power stepping very easily, but not continuous power modulation, usually QPSK is a little easier to get away with than QAM. And basically, you pick the one you want depending on how much power you have available to transmit, your bandwidth, how much complexity you can tolerate in the transmitter and the receiver. That's why we use AM for radio broadcast. The transmitter is pretty complex to get it good. The receivers are dirt simple. You need a diode. Channel is the actual air, wire, water, whatever you're sending it on. And whatever happens in the channel is going to happen to you. You get interference, you get attenuation, multipath distortion, all the ugly things that can happen to a wave in free space, a wave on a wire. This is where impedance mismatch would... who's asking about bus reflection? This is where I was going to talk about impedance mismatches. When you have a mismatched impedance, you get some portion of whatever wave you're sending down transmitted back at you. The actual constraint here is when your frequency hits, I'm sorry, when your wavelength hits 1/10 of the distance that you're sending, you have to start worrying about impedance. Anything shorter than that, and it usually doesn't matter because the amount of difference that you're going to see is negligible. At 1/10, that's where you start to see significant differences in power seen as opposed to power transmitted, and where you start to see significant echoes. And there's another theorem up there, Claude Shannon, bright guy, you should read about him. But it's called the capacity theorem. Basically, it says for a given channel, based on its bandwidth and your signal-to-noise ratio, there is a capacity in bits per second that you can reach. He doesn't say anything about how you can do it. He doesn't say even give any hints about how to do it. The best we've gotten right now is last I knew it was about a half decibel within that limit, but I think that we're getting a little closer than that now. It would be nice if he had told us how, but turbo codes, LDPC codes, I'm feeding back. All those codes are designed to help get within that very, very close level. It doesn't seem like a 0.2 dB improvement would be worth that much, but 3 dB is twice as much that you can send. So it's an interesting problem. There's a lot of stuff going on that's fun with that. But that tells you what you can do. It's a fundamental limitation. There's an expanded version that talks about what you can do given a certain probability of error. I wrote this very quickly, so I don't have it. Demodulation, it's decide what you saw. So after we've gotten the signal that we transmitted and we added some noise, so we wound up seeing that right there, you have to decide what came in. Was it this guy? Was it a lot of noise on this guy? Was it a whole lot of noise here? There are a lot of different algorithms for decoding. A lot of them depend on the coding method. The simplest is just to say, okay, this is my area that belongs to this signal. So if it came in there, it must be that signal. That's called a hard threshold decode, and they work. They don't work as well as some of the other methods, like a Viterbi algorithm. There are a lot of different ways to decide, based on your past, what that probably means.
They're simple to
implement. No. No, they're hard to.
I mean fixed area.
Oh, fixed area, yeah. Fixed area is very easy because you look and you say, okay, it's within area X, it must be that. Most of the decode algorithms are really complex computationally, and they take a lot of computer time or a lot of hardware to actually do. There's one called LDPC codes, which are actually in the same class as turbo codes in terms of capacity. And they were originally discovered in about 65. It stands for low density parity check if you're typing. They were discovered in like 65, but at the time there was no way to implement them because there was not enough computer power to implement the decode phase. It was easy to encode them, but decoding them was very computationally complex. Now we finally have enough to actually get them to work in real space, and there's talk about, I think 3G cell phones may be using LDPC, but I'm not sure. They may also be using a turbo code variant. Turbo codes are a lot more recent. They were discovered in about 90. So this is what provides us with our R. When you demodulate, you figure out where it lands, and then you have decoding, which is what I was really talking about, which is based on where it landed, what do I actually have? You have hard and soft decodes that refer to the precision. There's the Viterbi algorithm, which is a general purpose decoding algorithm. There are techniques for interleave decoding. There's just saying, okay, I'm within my area. A lot of different ways to do it. It depends on the coding method that you used, how much computer you have available, and how important it is that you get the right answer.
Can you give a quick rundown of Viterbi?
Yeah, I can do Viterbi very quickly, or very loosely, more correctly. Basically, with Viterbi, you look at the signals that you're receiving, and you trace back. There's a variety of different paths. You've ever seen an eye diagram. We'll do a simple one. So what you do is you look at the last X symbols that you've received, and starting from wherever you are, you trace back the shortest path along those symbols. Each symbol, this may be a 0, this may be a 1 change, or this is 0, 1, 1, 0. Each one from each state, you can only go to a 0 or 1 or however many. I'm sorry. The full eye diagram would have that and that added in for each one. So this might be 0, 0 is continue on in state, 0, 1 is move to next state, 1, 0, 1, 1 is all the way up. And looking at your stream from wherever you are, you trace back the shortest path. That shortest path is the correct answer in a Viterbi decode. The problem is that for usable codes, the diagram, the trellis diagram, gets very big, very fast, and the computation gets very big, even faster. It's not a very good explanation, I know. I'll sit down with you some other time if you want, after I figure out how they work again. Decompress, run on zip. I don't want to talk about it, it's easy. Interpolation, what's that?
What about zip fix? Errors in zip.
That's
not easy.
Totally different. That's after it's already rotted in transit. If you implement all these suggestions, it'll never happen in the first place, and zip fix isn't useful, so it's still easy.
Well, it'll happen. Just know the probability of how it's.
Yeah. Interpolation is looking back at this string of symbols that you've received and saying, do I interpolate like this? Linear interpolation, which usually doesn't sound very good. The typical interpolation is something called sync, which there's something called a sync function. It looks like that. And it relates to the a truncated window in time has this look in frequency. Now we're getting into...
Well, it depends on what window you're using.
What's that?
It depends on what kind of window function you're using.
A truncated flat top window
gives
a sync pulse as frequency. The corollary is that a sync pulse window gives a truncated flat top frequency window. So you use this interpolation because it usually produces better results than a straight linear. Somebody's taking DSP, huh?
Did.
Yeah.
Linear, straight linear would give you lots of high frequency.
Straight linear just generally gives you a lot of error because you probably had something that looked like that. So you've got all this error area in here. Sync is a lot better. Sometimes you just do linear because it's easy and quick and dirty. But for things where you're actually concerned about quality, you usually use a matched decode to whatever your encode was. So for typical sampling, you're doing a flat top sampling window. So you're using a sync decode because when you sampled back here, you sampled like that, took a new point. That's called sample and hold or flat top sampling windows. What am I drawing? Like that. So that's a flat top sample, a sample and hold. There's also something called natural sampling, but it's you can't implement it physically, so that would be you actually follow the signal as you sample it. That's sort of the ideal, but it doesn't work because you can't store it. You can't do that. It's just a mathematical trick that you use. Flat top is what almost every sampling system uses because you sample, you interpret whatever your sample was. Now we're starting to talk about like A to D architectures. I can talk about them, but not right now. So interpolation is just getting back from whatever your digital data was, this analog signal that you wanted in the first place. It's optional, just like quantization is optional. If you're just transmitting digital data, forget quantization, forget interpolation. You don't have to worry about them. Make fun of me, please.
You didn't go into spread spectrum at all. Did you talk about that?
Into spread spectrum? No, I didn't. Do you want me to?
Please.
Spread spectrum is what CDMA works on, a lot of other fun things that are military. Basically, instead of some modulations use a single sharp spike, so this is power, this is amplitude. Instead of modulating all your power into one narrowband transmission, spread spectrum says I can transmit at a low level across a broad frequency, and I'll get out a signal at a much lower noise floor. Basically, what you're doing in spread spectrum is you're spreading your spectrum out, just like the name, and transmitting a code masked... It's been a while since I've had to do CDMA or anything like it. You're doing a code mask over whatever your bitstream was in the first place. You code mask it with a pseudo-random code. Sometimes you add whitening noise. Sometimes the pseudo-random code is generated for whitening. And that is transmitted... How do spread spectrum transmit? It's actually frequency hopping is the typical one, where you transmit a portion here, and you're jumping frequencies back and forth. And you know what the other person's jumps are going to be, so you can pick the signal out of the noise at that point. If you don't know what the sequence that you're transmitting in is, then you can't transmit, you can't follow.
How do you sync up with how you're going to be hopping? Is there a set spectrum?
A shared secret.
Yeah, it's
like, your cell phone has an ESN, and then your telco knows your ESN, and they're like, well, it matches.
Not only that, but until you have their sync, you run yours maybe one pulse longer or one pulse shorter, and eventually you'll come around and you'll find them.
Okay. So, okay, but you need to have that shared secret. There's no set channel that you could exchange that secret on and then start hopping.
That would be crappy militarily.
You could do that. It'd be easy. It's possible there are systems out there. The only problem there is anyone can then listen in. The whole point of it.
It'd be crappy militarily.
Yeah. The way it works is that you have codes. Those codes actually start your sequence. So I think what happens is you get a control channel signal that's not CDMA'd, that's not spread. That tells you, okay, I'm going to start at this one in our sequence. But it only says this position in the sequence. It doesn't give the information needed to generate the sequence. So communicated in the clear is, I'm going to start here. There's a shared secret, like they said. It's just based on your cell phone's hardware numbers, really. in the military would be based on a unique device ID. Anything it needs to have the shared secret. So I'm going to start at this one, and then it'll generate its pseudo-random generator with a starting point set by a seed. So it's once you're there, it's pretty easy. You're listening at the right points. Other questions?
Relate that to Walsh codes.
Walsh codes are one of the coding... Walsh codes are orthogonal number systems. They're used as the spreading, as the sequencing. Mm-hmm. How it's done? There are better people to ask. Anyone? All right. I'm going to sit here for a while, so...